Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 1st, 2006. Our session today is titled Journalism and the Protection of Human Rights. Our presenter is Lowell Satry. Session number SAL 2006-02. Let's listen in.
Start the recording, whoever's on the other end. Okay, I'm Lowell Satry. I think a lot of you didn't see me before. Lori, is it?
Right. No, I didn't make it long.
No, yeah. See, one of the problems is I've seen so many people.
Yeah.
At this meeting or other meetings, and I'm beginning to wonder who I've seen and who I haven't in the various meetings. For those of you who haven't been here before, I'm a retired professor of history at Youngstown State University in Youngstown, Ohio. And I taught actually British Empire and British and European history for many, many years. And that, my teaching experience over the years in Empire, plus a few other books, including this one here, which is mine, which was published a year ago. Is the basis of much of what I'll be talking about this week. This is Chocolate on Trial, Slavery, Politics, and the Ethics of Business. I'm specifically going to be talking about this book tomorrow. And I'm going to look I'm going to take a look at diplomacy, my chain of thought.
I think everyone here understands.
It was awful. Maybe I don't even know if I have my notes for that.
It'll come tomorrow in the morning.
Oh, no, it'll come sooner than that. This is embarrassing.
It'll make this a better discussion, Lowell.
Right. I'm talking about diplomacy. You can come tomorrow to hear the other parts. It's going to be on. I'll figure it out somewhere.
That's your template for us to read the kiosk.
Yeah. I will tell you before the hour is over.
Oh, quiz good.
But tonight I want to take a look at at journalists and the protection of human rights, and not only human rights, like good rights in general, because some of the examples I draw on are, frankly, not just human rights or civil rights, it's other things too. And, working on this book, working on another article that I published many years ago and everything, I'm increasingly convinced that there are few things more important for our democracy, or any democracy, than the dissemination of information. We simply have to know. We need to know. And that's kind of the basis of what I want to look at, especially today. The First Amendment provides what we call the freedom of the press. Freedom of the press in the First Amendment is not defined. So hence, it is open to interpretation constantly. And that is one of the reasons why freedom of the press is so often debated, because there is no definition of it. We gained our legal system almost exclusively from England. Some exceptions. We actually got a little bit of it from France because of our ownership of Louisiana. And I think even to the present day, there are some laws and interpretations in the state of Louisiana that are different from at least other states.
Yeah.
But that is one of the exceptions. But we gained it from England. And for a long time, England did not really have freedom of the press. There are, in England and any number of other countries, there were, at least in England, not any longer, three ways in which freedom of the press can be limited, three common ways it is limited. One of the ways is simply by censorship, government censorship of the press. A second way is licensing, requiring them to have a license. And that's a pretty common way. England used that until license or duties or one way or another. Duties or stamp taxes or a number of ways that it can be limited. Actually into the 19th century. But the most serious limitation is what is called seditious libel of the government. I mean, that is, you can't criticize the government. And that was the biggest danger, because you didn't have to prove that a person was seditious in his or her criticism. All you had to do was to prove that he or she was the publisher or the writer of it. Which meant that it was almost open-ended, I mean, for the government. And it was very dangerous indeed then to criticize the government.
Okay, so are you saying, like, for sure when the American Constitution was getting written, this was still going on?
No, it wasn't. Oh, we'll take care of it. We'll get rid of it before that.
Oh, okay.
So that's context.
So we're in colonial America. I mean, we are, it is colonial America. The thing that essentially removed seditious libel from the American scene was in 1735, a man by the name of John Peter Zenger. It's a famous case. John Peter Zenger. It's a case in 1735. John Peter Zenger was actually, I think you call him a German-American. He's from Germany. He was a publisher. He was a writer. And he was very critical of, I think it was particularly the governor in the state of New York. And he was charged with seditious libel. He had a very, very difficult time finding any attorney who would defend him, because it was dangerous to indeed be associated with defending somebody who had been accused of seditious libel. He finally found somebody, a man by the name of Andrew Hamilton. Not Alexander, it was Andrew Hamilton. This is long before Alexander Hamilton. Andrew Hamilton. Who was an outstanding colonial attorney who finally took it on and was effective in arguing his case before the jury. And one of the things he in his conclusion, he said to the jury, "It lies with you whether henceforth newspapers shall have the courage to tell the truth." And the verdict was in favor of Zenger. It was a remarkably popular decision in the colonies, and it effectively removed seditious libel as a weapon on the part of the English government in the American scene.
So was the trial in the U.S. or
that was in the United States? It was in New York.
So yep. Even though it was colonial, the
But it didn't apply to England.
No.
Only later in the 17th...
Was it just for New York?
It was for New York specifically, but it. I suppose you could say that it was a form of common law. That indeed, once a decision had been reached in one colony, it spread to all the others. And I'm not aware that there were any other attempts to charge people with sedition.
So it's a turning point.
England didn't remove it on their statute books until 1790s it was, when it was removed. Now, the freedom of the press is technically a right of the people. And it is not what you could call a property right of the press. In other words, the freedom of the press in the First Amendment provides for the right for dissemination of information to the people. It follows that there is freedom of the press, but indeed, this is a right of the people and not of the press. Because indeed, for democracy to function, you need to have the freedom of information to the people. Now, who's the only one, however, that can test that? Who's the only one who can defend it?
The press.
The press.
Well, yeah.
The press is the only one that can defend it.
On our behalf.
Well, technically, yes. Well, not only on our behalf, even on the behalf of the press. I mean, because you know, I as a citizen can stand up and say, we've got to have freedom of the press. I want us to have freedom of the press. But if indeed the press can't have freedom of the press, I mean, it's what my voice is meaningless.
Right.
In other words, the press has to exercise.
It has to be law for the press.
Yes. Well, not only has to be law. It's not defined, on the other hand. It's not defined.
Was this a new experiment in our Constitution?
I think it was. Well, I mean, it was a...
I mean, you say...
Why would the Americans, in 1789, the writing of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, why would they have been concerned about guaranteeing the freedom of the press and freedom of speech and other things, when in fact they just gotten rid of England? They just gotten rid of their nemesis, well, 10, 15 years before.
Afraid it would reoccur?
Yes. Right. And there wasn't a threat, I mean, or a danger only from England, it was from themselves, from within their own country. And that, in many ways, that kind of ties into even what we call, you know, a division of powers in this country. I mean, that is, we have the...
It's called the Fifth Estate, isn't it? Something like that.
It's a what now?
Isn't it called the Fifth Estate?
Yes, it is. That's right. That's good. That is what the newspaper of journalism is called. It's called the Fifth Estate.
You write it down?
Just the estate. What? E-S-T-A-T. Estate.
Fifth. Real estate.
Fifth.
Real estate.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Second, third, and fourth.
It's a French concept, isn't it?
Well, the estate is the state, or stage, yeah, or stage is a French term, yeah.
Okay.
But that's what...
I think that was like the courts are one.
Okay.
And then our legislative executive is the other, and the legislative. Mm-hmm. But what would...
What's the fourth?
It's the fourth estate, not the fifth estate. But what is the fourth? Because I think they do call it the fifth estate. I don't know.
I think you're right that it's the fifth estate.
Okay. So I don't know.
Or you call it state. I mean, the fifth estate.
Okay. Yeah.
I'll have to look that up. I don't know.
And basically, it's as a protection of our freedoms.
Yeah.
Maybe the military is the fourth. Do you think
it's the fifth? I don't know.
Maybe.
Well, maybe it could defense.
Could well be,
could
yes.
Could well be, yeah. Yeah.
Could be.
Now, I want to give you at least a couple, one or two specific examples about the role of journalists, and these are specifically from some of my research. And these two examples, if I get around to the second one, are drawn from English history. That's what I teach, that's what I know best. And the first thing I want to talk about is the manufacturing of Lucifer matches. Or strike anywhere matches. This deals with an incident of the late 19th and early part, late 19th and early part of the 20th century. The making of Lucifer or strike anywhere matches was a relatively simple process. Now, strike anywhere meant that you could strike anywhere. They were handy. They were efficient, they were popular, they cost relatively little, versus other types of matches where indeed the striking had to be on a special surface. And they weren't as handy, I mean,
sure.
Right. So they were very, very popular. And it was a pretty simple thing. I mean, what you did was you prepared a mixture in which was included white phosphorus. because white phosphorus was the ignition element involved. And you'd spread it out over something, and it had to be fairly hot, kept hot to keep it liquid. And then you'd have matches. A match would be, these matches were twice as long as a normal match. About this long, they're wooden, carefully cut wooden sticks. About this long, and you'd wind these matches, these long matches, twice as long as you would wind, in a coil. You'd have, they'd wrap, be wrapped in a coil. In other words, you have a coil like this, the longer, you know, well, if you draw it, just you'd have a, you'd have a coil, you know, a web, this is much larger than, and then you'd have in it all the way our matches.
Oh.
Now, all the way, and so you'd have all the way around, and this
so
coil, this
you never
coil
had to spill your box of
matches. The coil is narrow, and then you'd have the wood sticking out on each side of this big coil. And what you do is you take one end and you put it in this groove that you've made, and you pull it out, and they're separate enough, so you'd hold it up and you'd let it dry. You dry it on one, you turn it over and put it down and pick that up, and you'd have these matches, and then what you'd do is you'd take them out of the coil and you'd put them in a machine that they'd be lined up, and then you'd take a cutter and snap them in half. So then you'd end up with twice as many, and it was an efficient way to do it, and then you'd box them. That was the making of matches. It wasn't actually automated as quickly in Britain as it was in the United States, partly because Britain had a lot lower labor costs. A scarcity of labor is normally what ends up driving inventions and machines. I mean, you don't develop a new machine if it isn't going to save any money.
And don't the British have a history at that point of being very inventive?
Who did?
The British did.
No, they were not as inventive as the Americans by the time.
Oh, by that time?
No, late 19th century.
Before
from roughly the middle of the 19th century and on, or even earlier, the Americans were better at it.
Okay.
Because the price of labor was higher in the United States. And that's what partly attracted so many Europeans, including Brits and Scotch and Irish, to the United States, was that our salary wages were much higher in this country.
And then was the living standard necessarily higher?
The what now?
Was the living standard higher too? Or just the
our standard of living was higher.
It was higher.
Yes.
By 1850.
Oh yeah, maybe even a little earlier.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
70.
No, I don't think that's
1750?
No,
it would have been a little bit later, but
okay.
We needed some
somewhere in the 19th century.
Industrialism to kick in.
Back to these matches.
Yeah, the matches. Okay, we'll get on with the match. In 1892, The Star, which was a London newspaper, reported an incident of what is called Fosse Jaw. Fosse jaw, P-H-O-S-S-Y, Fosse jaw, which is a short for phosphorus jaw. Reported somebody had suffered phosphorus jaw at working at a company by the name of Bryant and May. Bryant and May was the most successful match manufacturer in Britain at that time. It was located in London. It was owned by Quakers. Well, it was started by Quakers. By this time, in fact, it was a publicly held company. But the directors, Bryant and May, were both Quakers. A model company. A company that had a reputation of paying relatively good wages to their workers and paying wonderful dividends to the investors. 1885 to 1887, 3 years, they paid over 20% dividend. That's good. That's good today. It was good then.
Why
wouldn't you want it to have 20%? You might have over 5% today. You'd feel good.
Yeah.
Very successful company. And they were charged, and the Star newspaper said that Bryant and May had a case of Fosse jaw. Now, Fosse jaw was a type of disease or illness, whatever you want to call it, that essentially it seems, and they're still not absolutely certain today quite how some of this works, enters the cavities in the teeth. and would go into the jawbone and kill the jaw. It was the necrosis of the jaw. It killed the jaw.
Yuck.
So literally, you lost your teeth, then you would lose your jaw bone. You lose either the bottom or the top. If you lost the top, there's a pretty good chance you were going to die, simply because it also could go into the upper reaches of the brain and other cavities. It was terrible. And if you survived, and a lot of them did, you were physically disfigured. I mean, you lost, you couldn't chew your food after that time. And when you had it, you smelled. I mean, people didn't want to be around you. It was a miserable thing. And this is the type of thing in Britain by this time that their inspectors of factories and workshops, this was illegal. I mean, you had to report it immediately to inspectors. This is something that had been regulated for quite some time. And Bryant and May basically resisted it. They would not acknowledge that this was going on.
They're the ones who made these matches.
Yeah, this was theirs. This was their employee. It was found out that indeed, as was true, I guess relatively, well, we'll also say it was common, that the person had been, as soon as any phossy jaw was discovered, the person was pulled out of the factory. I mean, partly because you didn't want to have that kind of person in the factory. And was given medical treatment, and was paid £1 a week, which was good compensation at that time. It was paid for 31 weeks. And after that time, that person was no longer under the employment of the company, and indeed could probably never get a job in another MASH factory because they'd never let somebody of that look come back into the factory. So, another thing that the Star did, which was really unusual, it may have been the first time that any newspaper or journalist did this, was that they ran a list of the shareholders in the paper. In other words, trying to put pressure on the company through the shareholder, and included 25 clergy. Oh. 25 who were actually, this clergy would have, I think they were almost all Anglican. That was the wealthiest of the clergy. They also listed government officials who were shareholders, including Prime Minister Lord Salisbury, many MPs, as well as the Under Secretary of State for Home Affairs. And the Home Affairs, the Home Office in England, is the office in charge of inspection in any factory or anything. But essentially, Bryant and May weathered it out, and the shareholders did not protest. I read it in the newspaper about what went on, and nothing seems to have gone on. And indeed, Bryant and May declared a 17.5% dividend for the year. A little bit later that year, a government report came out that I've read that indicated. I found documents indicating that the government inspector, after this first incident, found out that indeed there had been 6 cases of phossy jaw over the last few years, including one that had died. But so I saw those documents in government archives, but the review that was published at the end of the year, like we have in this country, I mean, they'll all publish a yearly review and everything. They mentioned that indeed there had been some problems, and they pointed out, they mentioned this, but they didn't say anything about it. They didn't specify which company it was. They just pointed this out, and that was it. And so the issue disappeared until 6 years later in 1898, when the Star, the newspaper again, released information that a person had just died from phossy jaw. That gained more information at that time. They went on the Star to list 6 more cases of phossy jaw that had occurred recently. By that time, the government had no choice but indeed to step in and do even greater investigation. One of the things, though, that the Star pointed out was that the company doctors, Bryant and May doctors, had listed had listed death from, I'm going to say some cellulitis, but that might not be quite right, but it was something like that. And yet the autopsy has specifically said fossae jaw or necrosis of the jaw, so that indeed the company physicians had specifically not indicated what had happened. The only reason it came out in the autopsy was that the mother of the young man was 22 years old, plus the Star had demanded a public autopsy. And it was during the public autopsy, indeed, that the truth had come out, what had happened. The government became far more involved after that time, came up with, eventually pointed out over the previous 20 years there had been 9 deaths out of a total of 47 cases of necrosis at Bryant and May. They had been required all that time to report that information to the government, and they never had. They were slapped with a relatively minimum fine of £25. One of the reasons was, and it's true we have this in our country, is that the statute of limitations had run out on quite a few of the cases before they, because they were so old. One of the questions we raised about is, why did Bryant and May do this? Primarily for economic reasons. I mean, they had covered up this because it was their livelihood. They also covered it up because of their trying to maintain and protect their reputation, their very, very, very good reputation that they enjoyed. They also did it because of foreign competition. They also got away with it because the government inspectorship was so understaffed, they simply could not do effective inspection. Another thing that certainly provided for this was that the union, there was actually a union that had come about in 1889, but the union was very, very weak. I happen to be a big union person. And I mean, the reason I am is that individuals, in most cases, simply cannot stand up to any corporation of any size. So I'm a big union person. Our university unionized was the first state university in Ohio to unionize. So we unionized in 1974. And the Youngstown area itself is an old industrial city and was one of the most important union towns in the United States. There are certainly problems with unions, but that's something else. I mean, if there are problems, you've got to fix them. But I am, in fact, in favor of unions. I won't go on and just conclude this thing on the on Fosse job. In 1908, there was an international treaty banning the use of white phosphorus in the manufacturing of matches. And I believe it was the first international treaty to ban such use in the manufacturing of items. An international treaty. Now, the reason they agreed to it in England, and England was one of the last to sign it, there had been other, it had been in effect for 2-3 years, and the British finally signed it, was that it wasn't, well, the manufacturers of matches decided that it had become too expensive to maintain in the workshop all of the air vents, all of the protection required of them for workers. It had become too expensive, so it was cheaper simply to agree to this entire ban. So it's the first one, I think, that's ever.
You say it was international,
meaning? It was international, and it still applies today. I don't think you can't buy. They went to another type of phosphorus. It had been developed, in fact, in the late 1890s, and I believe the ones who developed it turned it over for international use for some relatively nominal payment. So it went moved very quickly into the domain, national domain, international domain. But it's one example of, in this case, the power of the press. It was important.
So the power of the press helped lead to this treaty.
It kept the pressure on. It kept the pressure on. Now, something else, and I really won't go into any detail on it, except to mention you can come back tomorrow for more details on it. And that has to do with my book, Chocolate on Trial. That revolves around, in one case, a reporter, and we would call him an investigative reporter, a man by the name of Henry Nevinson, who made a trip, actually working for Harper's Magazine, an American magazine. He was told, he wasn't told to do this. He was given it with £1,000 or something. Write about something exciting. And he wandered around London for a while and trying to figure out what he should do, what he should write about. And he heard, indeed, reports that the Portuguese plantations off the west coast of Africa used slaves to produce cocoa beans. And slavery had been illegal in Portugal for some almost 30 years. And he decided essentially to go and investigate that. And he went to both São Tomé, a tiny island off the west coast of Africa on the equator, and he also went to the Portuguese colony of Angola. And he was out for about 6 or 7 months. He barely lived through it, and that was true with almost anybody who tried to go, especially into the interior of Africa, because it had no natural defenses to many of the insects and the diseases. And he came back to England. He wrote Harper's published a series of his articles, indeed pointing out that slavery was alive and well in Portuguese West Africa. And he kept the issue before the public for several years. I won't say anything more about it than that. Henry Nevinson was one of the brilliant journalists of 20th century Britain. Was regarded as by one of his colleagues as being the finest war correspondent in Britain in the first half, roughly, of the 20th century. And it was not only as a war correspondent, he was a great defender of what we would call civil rights. He was particularly an outspoken advocate of women's suffrage. He wrote articles about it. He spoke in favor of it. He was one incident. He was covering a speech made by a government official, and he became. He was out there, and he finally yelled at him and hollered at him and everything. And he was, like several other members, dragged out of the place because of the way they were protesting. His own boss, the editor of his newspaper, was on stage that night. And he was taken to jail. He was taken and, charges filed and everything. But he was released, and he was so angry because he didn't want to be released. You know, I mean, from his point of view, he wanted to end up in jail. But he continued. He reported on the Irish Civil War at the end of World War I. He was a great defender of the Irish against the British. He was in India and defended them against the British. And also he was in Russia in 1905, covering the Russian Revolution of 1905, not the 1917 one. He was a great defender of civil rights nationally within England as well as internationally. And in this case, with regards to the cocoa beans being produced by slaves, he kept it at the forefront. He kept it for not only with his articles, he spoke about it, he appealed to humanitarian societies. He, for really 7 years, helped keep it in the forefront until, to a certain extent, it was resolved. Now, there are also a lot of particularly during that period of the late 19th, early 20th century, there were also a lot of investigative reporters in the United States. In many ways, it was a great age of American journalism. You've probably heard of the term muckrakers. The term muckrakers were essentially, investigative reporters. One of the greatest was Lincoln Steffens. Another one was Ida Tarbell, That may be the one you remember. Ida Tarbell, who actually lived fairly close to us. And she Oil City, wasn't it? Oil City, Pennsylvania, is where she was from, and that's only 40 miles from where we live at Youngstown, Ohio. She was the one who took on the Standard Oil Company, and especially with regards to monopoly powers. There were others who, I wish I could remember his name, Morris or Norris, who wrote the Sinclair Lewis, who wrote The Jungle. That was one of them, and...
Upton Sinclair,
thank you. Wasn't that the one for, was that meatpacking?
Yeah.
That was meatpacking, right?
Right.
Yeah, that was the meatpacking plant. And there were a whole series of these that came out in that period from the late 19th into the early 20th century. And they were muckrakers. I mean, they were investigative journalists. And, you know, in many ways, these kind of reporters are really despised by government officials because they're pain in the ass. Mm-hmm. You know? They just are. And I mean, but they are usually, they're usually loved. Now, I should point it out when it comes to freedom of the press. Freedom of the press does not give a newspaper or writer the freedom to write anything they want. I mean, in other words, you can't write false charges against somebody, whether it's a governmental official or anything. That's not a part of freedom of the press. I mean, if you make mistakes, if you err, if you are salacious in your comments, you can be sued and you're going to pay for it. That's freedom of the press doesn't grant that. Because I think some people think that freedom of the press means that a writer can write anything.
Well,
that's not the case.
That's why we have the checkmates and libel.
That's right.
Slander.
That's right.
Yeah.
And one of the questions, and we'll just do a little bit more and then we'll just discuss this, is the question, how much investigative journalism, responsible journalism, do we have in the world today? Or let's even go back a few years. You remember the problem with thalidomide?
Yeah.
It was a research team on the Sunday Times in London that was particularly involved in investigations of public health problems in the 1950s and the 1960s that finally brought about the exposure of the problems of thalidomide. They had what was called an insight team. They had teams that worked on various problems in public health. So indeed, it was journalism that brought it about. Another thing certainly had to do with, and this isn't civil rights, well, it is involved in rights of individuals, certainly, and that is the publication of the Pentagon Papers about what went on in Vietnam. It was Daniel Ellsberg was the one who was primarily responsible. It was published in the New York Times. And that's no easy decision for any newspaper to take that kind of step, because I don't remember if Ellsberg had gotten a hold of those under questionable or unusual circumstances. I think he had.
I just saw his
break. Yeah, so.
It was pretty messy.
And of course, one of the most celebrated that I remember has to do with Watergate and the Washington Post and Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward writing that. And I think I've heard both of them speak. I think both of them have come to Youngstown State University over the years. And they're still right. They've kind of gone their own separate ways. They're still very, very active. Today, I jotted down just a couple. There's one book, and there's a couple books. Eric Schlosser's book, Fast Food Nation.
Oh,
ever read that or heard of that? Huh? Deals with, the thing I remember about when I read it, and then Ellen read it after I did, had to do with chicken processing. I mean, the kind of thing that, after reading that, you think you probably won't ever eat chicken again. And I have a niece, it's Lucy, who they usually have their chickens out there, and somebody said, I don't know if it was Sammy or Lucy, said that they don't have chickens this summer, but that probably means they won't eat chicken. Because they know too much about what chickens are fed. And of course, if you ever go, especially to Arkansas, You breathe chicken manure all the way through the state, wherever you are.
One of my cousins on the Stenberg side is a chicken grower.
Yeah, I mean, it's something else. And the other one I mentioned is Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Nickel and Dime. I mean, and that is the almost impossible for women to manage to survive in these extraordinarily low paying jobs and kind of.
And it was just herself; she didn't have any children or anything.
Yeah. Yeah. You have any other books? I mean, what other investigative journalism can you think of, or books? I mean, because I think Ehrenreich is indeed a journalist, and I know Strasser is.
Yeah.
But, you know, or the other question is, how much investigative journalism is there today, and why is it difficult for there to be investigative journalism?
Okay, I think because it is so difficult, more people actually do it informed at all.
You're what now?
A form of they'll put it into a novel.
Yes, that's
safer. And then you can do all the research you want on something, but it's fiction. So you can push all the buttons you want. It's just a story.
That's done.
The public editor of our newspaper, The Oregonian, indicated because of the staffing levels, just the revenue that newspapers are making at this point isn't enough for them to support their own investigative journalism. They have very limited, they do target a couple maybe to do some investigative pieces because, of course, they want to only get a Pulitzer for that.
Yeah.
But there's probably one or two on a staff that's over 400. And that staff is a shrink down of what it used to be.
That's the biggest thing, I think, making it hard for newspapers is simply the cost. For investigative journalism is very, very costly.
Sure.
Does TV investigative journalism?
When I use the term journalism, I don't mean just TV. I mean any media.
Okay.
But do they, realistically? Do they? I know you're saying they could or should or something, but because they're included in the media, but I don't know that the electronic media
I'm not very good when it comes to journalism for television coverage because watch television.
There's 60 Minutes and those kinds of
things. I think those TV things have taken the place of it in popular culture because very few people read newspapers anymore.
Yeah.
Well, actually now, with Bill Moyers, that has been good investigative stuff.
Bill Moyers. Yeah, Bill Moyers.
Program
manager. Who's the one who just retired? Mike Wallace.
Yeah.
Is that the one in 60 Minutes?
Yeah.
I mean, that has tended to be investigative. And exposure.
Very investigative.
Yeah,
if you haven't watched TV, I mean, that's where more people would get it. And then it's internet.
Yeah.
I have trouble with internet.
No, I know, but that's where a lot of people go to do their investigating, whether they get good answers.
The problem with the internet, unless I'm reading a reputable newspaper, is that words are really cheap. On the internet. What we have to teach our students more than anything is you have to be critical of the internet.
There's
I think the reason there's not a whole lot of, the biggest reason there's not a whole lot of real investigative journalism is the immense pressure that comes from the government. Like you saw after the New York Times published their thing about the whole they're monitoring international financial transactions.
Yeah.
And Congress passed a resolution the next day that encouraged news outlets to support the war on terror, which I think is really scary. But the whole White House brass came out and said, like, condemning the New York Times over and over for publishing the story.
Really, you find the pulse of the nation if you watch, or if you read Newsberry. you know.
Well, and then also when it was exposed about this missing time with Bush during his quote military service.
Yes,
Dan Rather lost his job over that.
Yeah.
And the thing is that it's really not conclusive. I mean, it's more shadow there than.
But in recent years, because of such a intense political climate, a lot of what is called investigative journalism has got huge political overtones.
Right.
I mean, probably, I've looked at it just a few times in my career, and that is Fox News.
Oh, I was just going to say Fox. But
I mean, Fox News is got to be the biggest cheerleader for the government of any news source in the United States of the world.
But it also spawned Comedy Central. Or, I'm not sure which came first, but then we have Comedy Central as a counterpart.
Oh, okay. Now, right.
Or we have CNN.
Well, yeah, but I mean, Comedy Central is just about an antithesis of Fox News. You know, I mean, and you've got to know what's going on nationally to know what they're even spoofing on Comedy Central.
Yeah, but, you know, I suspect that, you know, the CNN and all the others, Fox News and Network News, is ultimately far more important.
Oh, I don't think so.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, actually.
It is.
Among the younger people?
We've certainly lived through some other parts of our history which were very highly charged, you know, maybe the Joseph McCarthy times and so forth.
Yeah.
I guess what scares me about now is that I don't know what phase we're in, or are we... Are we just getting worse and worse? Because I do think that there's getting to be less and less information available to us about what happens.
You know, in some ways, there's a lot out there. I mean, probably the best magazines today, monthly magazines, are The Progressive and Nation.
But who reads them other than...
Well, I try to.
Well, I know, the intellectual elites do. Right.
I know. They're not
very
big.
How about internationally? I mean, it just seems like...
International news?
Yeah. I mean, we have, you know, a skewed view of Israel. We have a skewed view of the war. Supposedly, we've got this great free press. But if we had ability, like where I live, to get international radio or news, how different that would look, even a British paper versus the U.S.
British papers are something else. I mean, if you haven't read British newspapers, they are... The thing about the British newspapers, one of the things, is that they present opinion pieces as factual.
Right, yeah.
I mean,
so
sometimes...
They aren't necessarily better, is that what you're saying?
They're not what?
They aren't necessarily better than the U.S.
No, they aren't. They're really good opinion pieces, but they're opinion. But you don't know that their opinion necessarily is.
They were called an op-ed or an editorial then, huh?
That's right. That's the main case.
But I guess I'm wondering if internationally are people from India or somewhere doing more than civil rights work?
So is that part of your question? Is investigative journalism going on anywhere in the world?
But on the other hand, I think it... With regard to the Iraq War, I think the New York Times has gone so far as to apologize. The newspaper, which is the great national newspaper, did not do an effective job of critiquing the government in regards to its decision to go into Iraq.
You mean they've apologized to the U.S.?
They've apologized to the readers.
Okay, to us as readers.
Yes.
Okay.
Or came close to it if they didn't offer it. And I think
they did.
Is that right?
The editor came out and said that she had gone along with the whole story about the weapons of mass destruction, and that's what the rest of the hive there said.
They had a Cheney plant in their editorial staff. I mean,
what's that?
Cheney had information he was passing to the top reporter editor of the New York Times. And that was skewing all the editor discussions on the news coverage of it.
And that's an old way to control news.
Well, sure.
Under Napoleon, France under Napoleon, in the 1800s, would essentially write the stories and send them out to the newspaper.
Well,
Well, actually, that's, what
kind
Israel
of the same
does.
Type of thing.
Yeah, Israel does that. And then Israel's control over the press is one that if you're not using their lexicon, which has been, they've run their lexicon through PR firms in the U.S. to make sure that they don't, you know, you don't say house arrest, you call it curfew. So that sounds like something that the teens have to be in, you know, by midnight. And
settlements.
Exactly. Moving it to neighborhoods in the description of East Jerusalem and their settlements. And if they don't use that lexicon, then, you know, the reporters, they're not going to get the permit or the, you know, the Israeli government
endorsement
actually to be there and to serve in that capacity, but also to get access to the official spokespeople when they want them. So it's highly, and this is all documented in, it was a Counterpunch article that Allison Weir, If Americans Knew, wrote recently. A lot of this was documented. And then a study was done on the Associated Press, also by If Americans Knew, on just the coverage of deaths. And you can see the bias and skew right there by that measure.
Now, another thing that I think makes investigative reporting more difficult is the tremendous economic resources of companies and the threat to sue. There is a what's the term I want to use here? There's self-censorship on the part of reporters or publishers. Because of their fear that indeed there will be libel charges or something filed against them. For a small newspaper of any sort, they probably can't survive it. Even if they win, they can't survive it. A big newspaper like the New York Times can manage that, and the Washington Post and some of the big ones. Small newspapers can't. Now, there's another thing that restricts dissemination of information, and that is one newspaper towns.
Right.
There's no alternative press.
Right.
And also that one newspaper that survives them is dependent on advertisers. So it's...
Right. Is there any other avenue other than big business newspapers or big business electronic media where there would be a source to disseminate information to the public about human rights or civil rights?
The great thing that has happened is the web. I mean,
what's happening there?
That is the great disseminator.
Is a main one. Counterspin, they'll often run things even that the nation maybe might run, that where the general public would be getting it through their normal sources. And Truthout also is a... They send out a daily thing. I scan that. That's what I do for my news now.
Are you German?
No, but I've done 3 years of media advocacy on Israel-Palestine.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So in meeting with the
editors,
we had to research it because as we wrote our studies, we had to research what are the journalistic standards.
Yeah.
And so we did research.
Are you doing this for the church or for some or just for yourself?
I'm a volunteer.
Okay.
But I've done it full time as a volunteer. Shifwich Haddock. Call myself
I didn't know if you were paid to do it.
No, I'm not paid.
Yeah.
There's a lot of committed people who are doing this unpaid.
You know, another thing that makes it hard is simply the government control of news. Mm-hmm. The Gulf of Tonkin resolution many years ago, I mean, it was misleading or just an outright lie on certain parts of it. I mean, the fact that they said that the ships had been attacked. Well, I mean, I think I'm right when I say that specific attack had not taken place. And government can be powerful with that. And it's not, you know, we finally found out about it, 20 years later.
Yeah.
I think we're going to stop.
So,
we're right down to resolve all the problems.
So do you feel, basically, there isn't much investigative journalism going
on? No, I think there's still quite a bit. I actually think there is quite a bit.
I don't mean, don't you think it always is going on, especially when there's suppression, political suppression? It's just that it takes different forms in how it seems.
It's
one of my favorite historians said, "You can't shut up writers." And historians, you can send them to jail, you can kill them, but you can't shut them up, even if you kill them.
But you can delay the message.
You can delay the message.
Yeah, right.
But boy, once it gets out later, it's even more powerful. You can delay it.
One of the problems I think why we have trouble recognizing investigative journalism today is that we are overwhelmed with information.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I really think that may be why it's hard to detect.
You have to be so
if there's investigative journalism.
You have to be so focused on one subject, like she is. I mean, and even
and that, I can't keep up.
I have
100 emails a day.
Yeah.
Because in the media advocacy I do with the Oregonian, mm-hmm. I probably send one to two things a week to the editors. But I have to be very careful in the selection. So I thought to review, as the public editor says it, a couple of us that had met with him as we presented our study, he said, "Well, you've become editors."
Mm-hmm.
And I really thought about that.
Right.
Because they're doing something similar.
Right.
But they can allocate, for World News and our newspaper, we get, maybe a page and a half.
Yes.
So then on this particular issue, then they'll get a certain number of inches and decide what off-the-wire services they're going to use. Etc. Anyway, I can talk way too long on this.
We're all editors.
Well, we all.
As a teacher, particularly, you do more editing than anything else because you have to decide what to do, and what to do.
Exactly.
That's the story of my life.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.